Thorpe and Manx.
"You came to rescue a bloody slave," the captain said. He had a low York accent.
"He's no slave," Drake said. "And if I looked through the cargo, how many more people would I find who've been tricked into slavery? All of them?"
"You're a fool."
Cap had a fistful of the man's uniform at the shoulder and gave him a jerk.
"Hey, Captain, what do you say we shove a pound of sugar up his arse and toss him into that room we came out of? The room will tear him apart."
The ship shuddered. Fresh alarms sounded. "Commander," Drake said into the comlink, "how are we doing?" Tolvern's voice came through in his earpiece.
"We're right up against the hull, sir. Probably 15 feet away from you on the outside, starboard side."
"I need you on the inside, Tolvern."
"Working on it, sir. Hull is compromised. We need to make a seal, or you'll all be sucked into space."
Another shuddering explosion. "Better hurry, or we'll be sucked out anyway."
2 minutes, sir."
"You'll pay for this," the captain of the slaver said. "York Company is backed by royal sanction."
Drake fixed him with a cold gaze. "This ship may be owned by York Company, but the cargo isn't." That law was over 20 years old, put in place as a good-faith measure during one of the many truces between Albion and the Hroom. York Company, with its ties to both the Lord Mayor of York and the Crown itself, had been accused of running slave operations within Hroom-controlled worlds. Since then, slaves were owned by third parties, not York Company.
"Makes no difference, we transport the cargo."
"Who bought these people? Who are you working for?" When he didn't answer, Cap gave him another shake.
"You better answer real quick, or my mate here will cut you up good."
Carvalho drew his saber at this threat. The ship shuddered again, but this time Drake heard voices from his right, on the other side of the starboard side wall. It must be Tolvern's crew, cutting through the last few inches to the bridge.
"Look at your friend,"
the slaver captain said with a disgusted nod toward Nib Pym.
"He doesn't want to go. All he cares about is his sugar. Look, can't stop searching for it. See those shelves in the corner? Emergency rations in case the Hroom ever revolted. 50 pounds of the white stuff."
Nib Pym stiffened at these words, as if an electric shock had ripped through his limbs. He broke free of Oglethorpe and Manx, who seemed to have relaxed their grip on his arms, and dashed toward the shelves. Drake had moved toward the slaver captain since they'd arrived on the bridge, and with Cap and Carvalho keeping the prisoners, he was the only one in position to intercept the Hroom before he reached the sugar. The last thing he needed was for Nib Pym to stuff sugar into his mouth until he fell into a swoon, eyes milky and glazed, like they were blocked with cataracts. He lowered his shoulder to stop the hard-charging alien. Nib Pym slammed into him, and he fell. Now on the ground, Drake got his arms around the Hroom's legs and temporarily brought him down. But even for his size, Nib Pym seemed possessed of unusual strength in his desperation to reach the sugar. He got back up and sprang at the shelves, ripping open the doors. The slaver captain took advantage of the chaos to grab for Carvalho's sword. The other three officers went for Cap's gun. One of them got his hands around the barrel, and she squeezed the trigger. It fired. The men fell back with a cry. Cap turned on the other two and gunned them down. Carvalho fought free and slashed at the slaver captain. The captain fell back, clutching a bloody gash across his chest. Carvalho lifted the saber for a killing blow.
"No,"
Drake cried, rising to his feet.
"We need him alive."
Nib Pym let out a terrible wail from the other side of the room, his owl-like voice rising to a screech. He was tearing through the shelves, which contained logbooks, hand computers, and a variety of electronic odds and ends, but no sugar. The whole thing had been a bluff on the part of the slaver captain. Shouts came from behind Drake. He glanced over his shoulder to see Tolvern's head and shoulders squeezing through a breach in the hull. Drake reached for the Hroom.
"Nothing here. Time to go. Come on."
Nib Pym wheeled on him. His long, bony hand formed a fist, and before Drake could flinch, the Hroom struck him across the temple, and he went flying. He hit the ground dazed, and was only partially aware of the shouting and struggle. Oglethorpe and Manx were struggling with Nib Pym. Someone was crying for them to shoot him, or maybe not to shoot him, Drake couldn't tell. Above it all, Nib Pym raged in his native tongue and then in English. He pleaded to be released, begged for sugar, begged them to kill him. Henry Upton shuddered. Drake got on his hands and knees and scrambled toward the hole Tolvern had opened in the hull. Somehow he made it through to his own ship. Ajax's initial moves had caught Rutherford flat-footed, and it took some time to regain the initiative. After sending over boarders, Drake's ship had then methodically reeled in the merchant ship. Ajax took Henry Upton with her into a barrel roll. Clever tactic. Made it impossible for Rutherford to get a clean shot. After his own attempt to harpoon the pair failed, Rutherford gave up worrying about collateral damage. He fired his cannon at Ajax, trying to cripple her shields. About one shot in three hit the merchant ship instead. Flashes of light and puffs of debris vented into space. After several minutes of this, Ajax apparently had what she wanted and cut loose. She shoved off from Henry Upton and began a rapid acceleration to what Rutherford presumed was a jump point to flee the system. He maneuvered around the crippled merchant ship, now tumbling helplessly end over end, and set off in grim pursuit. It would take Ajax time to accelerate to jump speed, and however many hours to reach the jump point itself. Meanwhile, Rutherford methodically pounded at her rear shields with missiles, and then used his cannon again when he'd caught up to her. The other cruiser did not fire back, but kept all power on the shields. Even so, they shortly began to weaken. Ajax pulled a couple of slick maneuvers to lose him, but Rutherford had little difficulty keeping pace. It was only a matter of time. And then a distress call came through from Henry Upton. The captain of the galleon claimed two hull breaches he was unable to seal. The escape pods had been destroyed in vigilance bombardment. The merchant ship would shortly break apart, with all souls lost, unless Vigilant rushed back to give aid. Rutherford turned to his tech officer.
"McCormick, how many on board, Henry Upton?"
"A crew of 32, sir,"
McCormick said after a moment,
"assuming none have been killed."
"What about cargo?"
"Plus roughly 850 slaves," McCormick said.
"Acceptable losses if we can bag Ajax," Commander Pitsfield said. "The York Company will holler, but what can they do? Ajax is our prize."
Rutherford wasn't sure, but he'd rather not find out.
"Hail the enemy."
Drake came on the screen moments later. He looked haggard, and there was a streak of blood across his right temple. The view was tight, Rutherford noted, with nothing else visible on the bridge, as if his old friend didn't want conditions to be seen.
"Calling to surrender?"
Drake asked, with what looked like a forced smile.
"Very well, I accept."
Rutherford had no time or patience for banter. He explained the situation with Henry Upton.
"You're beaten. You know this, and I know this. It is only for you to decide to capitulate or be destroyed."
"So you'll keep coming after me and let all those people die?
There must be close to 1,000 on board. Why don't you go back and save them while there's still time?"
Rutherford smiled.
"You can do that yourself. Lower your shields and come too. I'll follow you to the merchant ship. No more lives will be lost."
"Merchant ship? Call it what it is, a slaver. Do you know who was on board?"
"Your pilot, yes, I know."
"He is an officer in the Royal Navy. We protect our own, Nigel. Doesn't matter if we are talking about human or Hroom. You know this. You felt this way yourself at one point, or was I mistaken?"
Rutherford ignored the forced familiarity of Drake using his given name.
"He's not an officer anymore. He's an eater. I don't care what he was, that's what he is now. And is anyone surprised? Maybe they'll all be eaters eventually. Maybe it's inevitable."
He made his tone conciliatory.
"Stand down. Surrender. We'll discuss matters when I have you on board Vigilant. If you have a grievance, I'll hear you out. No need to rush back to Albion. We can put in for repairs at Hot Barsa."
Drake turned his head slightly to the right, as if listening to someone speaking from off-screen.
"They're now saying 20 minutes until Henry Upton breaks apart.
That doesn't leave you much time. Better turn around before it's too late.
Stand down, Drake, Rutherford said. You'll be responsible for all those deaths.
Drake smiled and then cut the comlink. Rutherford cursed at the blank screen. He'd hoped Drake was bluffing, that he wouldn't keep running.
Turn around? Pittsfield asked. Captain?
Rutherford didn't answer. It wasn't only the slaver that was troubling him, but that Drake had grown so ruthless and desperate. Rutherford had hoped to take him on board after capturing Ajax, speak to him as one captain to another. Drake's behavior made no sense. He truly believes he is innocent. The evidence against Rutherford's old friend had seemed solid. Records confirmed it. The computers had shown falsified logs. The man had blundered and then attempted to deceive both his crew and the Navy. This mutiny was one more mistake in an escalation that would see Drake dead. But there was a familiar note in his friend's voice. Confidence, the rightness of purpose for which he was known. Rutherford had forgotten how utterly certain of himself Drake could seem when he thought he was in the right. A niggle of doubt burrowed into Rutherford's gut. What if he was trying to kill an innocent man? He's not innocent of mutiny, that much is clear. Yes, but there were times when a man could disobey a wicked order. What if Rutherford were ordered to bring the entire fleet into orbit around Albion and bombard it with nuclear weapons? Would he do it? Surely not.
We need orders, Captain, Pittsfield said, sounding nervous.
Continue pursuit. Give that traitor all he can take. We'll take his ship anyway, and he'll have the blood of those people on his hands. His decision, not ours.
Yes, sir.
But no sooner had he spoken than a message came through from the fleet. When Rutherford had come around Cold Barsa to find Ajax trying to board the merchant ship, he'd sent off a subspace message to fleet headquarters to say that he'd engaged the enemy. It was standard practice, in case there were any vessels in the area who might send help. He'd reported that Ajax had Henry Upton harpooned and intended to board her. Nearly an hour had passed since he'd sent the message, and an answer had come back from Albion. Destroy Ajax if you must, but do not risk the merchant ship. Rutherford sat in stunned disbelief when Pittsfield relayed the message.
Repeat that message, Commander?
Pittsfield read it again.
We can sacrifice a Royal Navy cruiser, but we're to preserve a beat-up old merchant ship?
Rutherford said.
What is Henry Upton worth? A few thousand pounds? Her cargo a few thousand more?
That is what it says, sir.
I know what it says, Commander.
Rutherford stared at the viewscreen at Ajax, her hull pitted by the bombardment of Vigilance cannons, which had punctured the shields and were now starting to tear up her underbelly. A few more broadsides, and he'd have her crippled and helpless. There would be no need to destroy Ajax or its crew. Another shot broke through, and fire and debris flared into space.
Perhaps it is a mistake, Pittsfield said. I could request clarification. The order doesn't make sense. It will take another hour to get an answer. By then...
It is no mistake, Rutherford said bitterly. Break off pursuit. We will obey orders.
But, sir, do what I say.
Mutters and dark looks swept over the bridge as Pittsfield relayed the captain's orders. Under normal circumstances, Rutherford would not have tolerated such dissent, but they only mirrored his own anger at being called away. The enemy vanished from sight as Vigilant swung around to return to Cold Barsa. Henry Upton was still turning end over end, her distress calls ever more frantic. Rutherford reversed the engines when they got within a few tens of thousands of miles, slowing rapidly to match the merchant vessel's course and speed. He fired a harpoon to grab hold so he could stabilize her enough to bring in. But the harpoon came loose when they started to bring her in. It had attached itself to a damaged part of the hull that now broke free. Rutherford ordered another harpoon launched. This one took hold. But when the merchant ship was still 100 miles out, a tremendous fissure opened midway down her hull. She broke in two,
spewing debris into space. By the time Vigilant finished picking through Flotsam, she'd rescued fewer than 20 survivors, these protected in undamaged airlocked sections of the ship. Because the ship had split right down the central hold, the only room among the survivors were crew. The cargo had all vented into space. These few room survivors were still raving eaters, demanding their sugar rations the instant they came on board. And, of course, Ajax had vanished, cloaked, fleeing toward some distant jump point. The Barsa system was full of them. Vigilant made a course for Hot Barsa, with the largest two bits of wreckage in tow. Long before she arrived, the first of many recriminating messages had begun to arrive from the Admiralty. Chapter 8. After Tolvern had brought Captain Drake back from the slaver and broken free, she'd turned over the bridge with a flood of relief. Drake would save them. She didn't know how, but he would. But for the next hour, things had seemed excessively grim. Vigilant had kept pace beneath them, only a few hundred miles away. She'd rolled onto her side to present a broadside to Ajax's belly. They'd already taken several shots underneath, but the truth was that nowhere on the shields could take a sustained bombardment. Tolvern was itching to return fire, but that would mean lowering their own shields. The instant that happened, Rutherford would tear them apart. "Come on, Nigel," Drake muttered after he'd spoken to Rutherford about Henry Upton's desperate situation. "Do the right thing." His face was pale and his jaw rigid. Blood seeped out from beneath the bandage Tolvern had sprayed on his forehead. The terrifying thing was that Drake had told Tolvern if Rutherford did not, in fact, give up the pursuit, then he'd surrender. He wouldn't sacrifice all those humans and room left on Henry Upton. She didn't relish the thought of being responsible for the death of all souls on the slaver, but if it were up to her, she would keep running. Any number of things might happen to give them a chance to reach the jump point. Jane's cool voice came over the comm system.
37 hours to jump point at current trajectory and acceleration.
Cap was sitting in the pilot's chair. She had her eyes closed, her nav chip in communication with the nav computer. But she opened her eyes at Jane's voice.
"We know that, you stupid cow!"
Drake let out his breath. Tolvern looked up to see Vigilant peeling away, cannons retracting. She scarcely dared hope. A feint? Would more naval vessels come tearing in from their flanks? When none appeared, she finally stopped holding her breath. Drake slumped in his chair, and Tolvern hurried over to catch him in case he fell. He looked up with a dazed expression. He should be in sick bay for a concussion. Nib Pym had apparently struck him on the temple with a closed fist before they'd subdued the alien and dragged him through the breach to Ajax. The room was currently locked in an isolation cell.
"I'm sorry," she said. "This is my fault."
"Rubbish. You executed perfectly."
She used her sleeve to mop at the blood now trickling down his temple.
"You should go to the sick bay, sir."
Drake grimaced and glanced back at the screen.
"Yes, perhaps you're right. Keep us on course. If Rutherford turns around and gives pursuit, hail me at once."
"Yes, sir."
"Otherwise, see to our pilot."
A quick glance at Cap, who looked like she was half-dozing in the pilot's chair.
"We need Nib Pym here as soon as possible."
Tolvern watched Drake rise to his feet and go for the door. He was moving like an old man, his arms wrapped around himself as though he'd cracked a rib. She wanted to go to him, urge him to lean his weight into her, but was afraid that gesture would be misinterpreted. The captain was a tall man with a strong, handsome jaw. He had dark hair and piercing hazel eyes with flecks of gold in them. When she'd first been assigned to Ajax, nearly 5 years earlier, she'd been in awe of him, so much so that a fellow ensign had joked that she was in love with the young captain. That had left Tolvern so flushed and angry that she'd challenged the accuser to a duel, which had been laughingly declined, at which point she calmed. She wasn't in love with him, that was rubbish, and anyway it would have been pointless. Drake was of noble blood, and she was a commoner. Even if she had been so inclined, and she was not, she insisted to herself, she may as well fall in love with the Crown Prince, for all the good it would do. Drake had never treated her like a commoner, but with exacting correctness, according to their comparative naval ranks, he consulted but never deferred, and since she had always put his weight in favor of her various promotions, he must hold her in some esteem. If only she were as confident in herself. Tolvern stayed on the bridge for another hour, to be sure that Rutherford had let them escape. No word from Drake. She figured he was sleeping off a concussion. She told Cap to maintain their current course, except on override from herself or the captain, then went down to the sickbay. She resisted the urge to check in with Dr. Lee to see about the captain's concussion, and instead went to the isolation cells. It was here they kept people quarantined who'd been exposed to a xenovirus, or who were receiving treatment for severe radiation exposure. There were only 5 cells, enough for a contaminated away team, but not enough to contain a major outbreak. Right now, only 1 cell had a green light above the door. 2 men stood in front of the cell block. Tolvern's thoughts were elsewhere as she arrived, and she supposed they'd been posted as guards. Only when they looked up, their low voices abruptly ceasing, did she fully take in the scene. One of them was Carvalho, the Ladino she and the captain had spotted in the mess cozied up to Corporal Cap, and the other was one of the older criminals freed at the same time Tolvern had rescued Drake. He had an ugly scar across his right cheek, but it was almost obscured by gray and black whiskers, since the man hadn't shaved in, 10 days now? Tolvern couldn't remember his name at the moment. The men were standing too close to each other, as if they'd been sharing a secret or swapping something between them. She swore she caught a guilty look on the bearded fellow's face, and he shoved his hands so quickly into his pockets that she figured he was hiding something. Carvalho, however, leaned back against the wall with such a cool look on his face that she questioned her growing suspicion. "What are you doing here?" Her hand wanted to go to her sidearm, even though she told herself that was ridiculous.
"Nothing," Carvalho said. "Quiet place to shoot the breeze, that's all."
"Is one of you on guard duty?"
"Huh?"
"The guard," she said. "Who is it?"
The second, older man looked at her as if this were the most ridiculous thing he'd ever heard.
"Ain't no guard. Can't hardly spare one, now can we?"
"You two seem idle enough. Don't you have somewhere better to go? Engineering could put you to work, assisting the bosun or some such. We've got all sorts of trouble, and no use for idleness."
"Not our shift," Carvalho said sullenly. "We're off until 2200.
"I'm pretty sure this is all hands on deck, so unless you're asleep or eating, I suggest you find something useful to do."
They slouched off from the isolation cells, and she stared hard at their backs until they disappeared. She turned her gaze back to the empty corridor. What the hell were those men doing here anyway? Tolvern stepped up to the window of the cell with the green light above the door. Captain had said Nib Pym was in a bad way. She didn't want to open the door and find him crouched, ready to fling himself at her. The cell was about 8 feet by 4 feet, with a bunk along the wall and a stainless steel toilet. Some shelves for personal belongings, a tight-weave carpet covered floors, walls, and ceiling. The cell had an entertainment screen, but no keyboard or other computer equipment. The pilot wasn't lying on the bunk, and he wasn't watching or doing something on the screen. Instead, he'd squeezed himself into the far corner and drawn his bony knees against his chest. His high, bald head was tucked between his knees. He was still dressed in the rags Drake had found him in when he'd been squeezed into the hold of the slaver with hundreds of other room. A uniform lay in one corner, tossed in apparently, then ignored. Tolvern checked her sidearm. It was loaded, but she wished she'd swapped it at the armory for a stun gun. If Nib Pym tried anything funny, she didn't want to kill him protecting herself. She put her hand against the reader.
"Commander Jess Tolvern," she told it. "Open the door."
The door slid open. The Hroom didn't look up.
"It's me, Tolvern. How are you doing, mate?"
Nib Pim lifted his head slowly, like a turtle emerging from its shell. He looked at her through large, watering eyes.
"Did you bring my ration?"
Tolvern took a deep breath. She was still in the hallway and could shut the doors without moving backward, in case he decided to come after her. Nib Pim had always been such a calm, measured sort that it felt like pure fancy to be expecting such a reaction. And yet, he struck the captain, don't forget that.
"I have to tell you something. It's going to be hard to hear. I need you to stay calm."
"I want my ration. It is late."
"We need to detox you. I'm afraid there aren't going to be any rations."
Nib Pim had scarcely moved except to lift his head, but now he unfolded himself like a giant insect and sprang for the door. He loomed above her, nearly 7.5 feet tall to her 5'7", and his arms were so long that his fingers were practically at her throat before she could so much as take a step backward. She was so startled she didn't have a chance to speak, but slammed her hand on the pad. The doors zipped shut, and not with the cautious glide of the doors on the lift, but with all the urgency of a breached airlock sealing itself. Nib Pim slammed against the other side with an incoherent scream. He shoved his face against the tiny 3-inch thick window.
"Give me my sugar!"
Nib Pim beat and thrashed against the door as Tolvern backed away. She came out of the cell block and called down to engineering. Barker came on.
"Hey, Barker, it's Tolvern. I'm short-handed. Got anyone you can spare?"
Her calm words belied her pounding heart and dry mouth.
"What do you think?" he grumbled. The gunner sounded exhausted and ready to bite her head off.
"I really need someone. Nothing difficult, guard duty."
"Oh, you do, huh? You got any idea what we're dealing with down here? The engines are stateless yellow, and that's the best of what I've got. Shields damaged, and we're still leaking air. You don't even want to know what the waste system is like at the moment. Let's just say I wouldn't drink the water until further notice."
"I'm not messing around," she said. "You must have someone. I need a guard, and it's urgent."
"Ha! Okay, then, fine. I've got a couple of freed prisoners down here. More trouble than they're worth. How about I give you one of them?"
She thought about the two men she'd caught in the cell block when she'd arrived.
"No good. I need someone I can trust. Captain is in the sick bay with a concussion, and I need to stay on the bridge until he comes back. I can't be trusting smugglers and pirates."
When he was silent on the other end, she said,
"I'm in command, Barker, and I'm telling you what I need. Do I need to make it an order?"
He sighed.
"Fine, but you've got to give me more than that."
She told him how Nib Pim had nearly attacked her.
"Doesn't seem to be anyone here keeping an eye on him. I need someone with a gun and some discipline. Someone who isn't so dumb as to open the door or to stand outside pouring sugar into his coffee, know what I mean?"
"All right. I've got someone. Wouldn't say he's the brightest fellow I've got, but he obeys orders. You know Harrison?"
"Yeah, he'll do. Send him up."
Tolvern cut the link and made her way back up to the bridge. She passed Harrison in the hallway, and then she shared the lift with Carvalho. No sign of the second man. She stared straight ahead, but the big Ladino's eyes ranged up and down her body. Blasted criminal types. She couldn't wait until they could all be dumped in some backwater and Drake could get a real crew. She endured his visual groping until he got off, then continued up to the bridge. No sign of the captain yet. Cap was lounging in the pilot's chair, smoking a cigar, as if it were the crew lounge. Tolvern ordered her to put it out. Cap grunted, took a final puff, and ground it out in an ashtray. A trail of smoke drifted into the air, as lazy and sullen as the corporal herself.
"Where do you want to go, anyway?"
Cap asked.
"Back to the jump we came in on?" "No, that's where they look for us." "I could take us to Phantalus. It's closer." "Hmm."
As far as Tolvern could remember, the Phantalus system was the gateway to nowhere useful.
"And where do we go from Phantalus?"
Cap looked sheepish.
"Back to Griffin Shoals." "Do you know any other jumps from this system?" Now just those two. Well then, Phantalus, I suppose. It's a different route, so there is that much. Guess it's better than sitting around scratching our balls, Cap said. Not that either woman possessed such a thing, but why speak properly when a vulgarity was at hand? Again, Tolvern was counting the hours until they could dump Cap, Carvalho, and the lot of them. She thought briefly about calling the sick bay to see if she could get advice from the captain, but she knew what he would tell her. Until they had Nib Pym back in the pilot's chair, they didn't have much choice but to backtrack toward the Griffin Shoals. Seemed to be the only place Cap could reliably get them that wasn't swarming with Royal Navy. About an hour later, Tolvern got word from medical that Drake was under light sedation in his own quarters, sleeping off his concussion. Tolvern had been awake for almost 20 hours now. Under normal rotation, she'd be midway through her sleep shift. In fact, getting herself some rest would be not only desirable but expedient. Hard to say how long until the captain returned, and they needed someone fresh at the helm. Maybe she could grab a few hours as they made a straight line toward the jump point. But who could she leave the bridge to? Smythe was fresher, only midway into his shift, but he was a tech officer in every sense of the word. If it wasn't computer-related, he didn't know what to make of it. She could call Barker again, see if he had anyone else to spare, but she could only imagine his tone of voice. She turned her gaze to Cap, who had picked up the cigar and was chewing on the end while she thumbed through the nav computer with her eyes half closed. No, don't even think of it. So Tolvern settled into the captain's chair with a suppressed sigh. Nothing was happening on the viewscreen, so she queried Jane to ask about the shields. The answer was not pretty. She was running through scenarios in her head of what they would do if they approached the jump point to find a couple of Navy corvettes lurking, when Jane picked up a message sent via the coded Royal Navy subspace channel. Supposedly, Jane always spoke in the same tone, whether she was relaying what was for supper in the mess or warning of pending core meltdown, but Tolvern swore she could hear all manner of emotions in the computer's voice. This time, Jane sounded skeptical as she relayed the message.
Captain and crew of HMS Ajax, return to Albion and surrender, and you will be granted a full pardon.
Chapter 9. Drake woke to his comlink chiming from the bedside table. At first, it seemed like a part of his dream, in which he was on the deck of Ajax giving battle orders. Only at the same time, in that strange way of dreams, the ship wasn't Ajax. It was a seagoing vessel, a quaint old Earth-style aircraft carrier. They were being attacked by warplanes of the Imperial Japanese Navy, and Jane's computerized voice kept warning him that a wave of kamikazes was inbound.
Captain, are you there, Captain?
Only gradually did he come awake, and even more gradually did he realize it wasn't Jane's voice he was hearing, but Commander Tolvern's. Why was he so groggy? Oh yes, the concussion, the sedation. He reached for the comlink.
Yeah, what is it? Can I come in?
As soon as he sat up, the room sensed his movement and a cool blue light suffused his cabin, just bright enough to see its general outlines. During the bombardment, the doors to his cupboards had been knocked open and his books had come spilling out. He hadn't bothered to pick them up. He'd barely managed to strip out of his clothes and toss them to the floor as he collapsed into bed. Open, he said. The door to his room slid open and a blinding light came in from the hall. He squinted until the door had closed. Tolvern stood silhouetted near the doorway.
Problem?
Many problems, she said. But mainly you'd been asleep for some time and Doc told me to check on you.
The wall display read 0412 hours. Good heavens, how long had he slept? 11 hours? He hadn't set an alarm, but couldn't remember the last time he'd needed to. He kept his body under the same discipline as the ship, and normally found himself waking between 6 and 7 hours after he crawled into bed, regardless of how tired he was. That must have been strong stuff the doctor had given him. He tossed off the blanket and grabbed for his trousers, which were located at the foot of his bed where he tossed them. By the time the lights finished coming up, he had an undershirt on, too. Tolvern looked around the room, a half-smile at her lips. What a pigsty. How do you live in such filth?
Funny girl, he said, wincing as he bent to grab some headphones and stick them in a drawer. Together they picked up the books that had been knocked out of his shelves by Vigilance guns. In a moment, they had everything straightened up. His room was small by land standards, but of course it was still the largest quarters on the ship. He had his own bathroom, a small kitchen, so he didn't have to eat all his meals in the officer's mess, and a small nook for reading that also boasted a great audio system on which he listened to classical music, Bach and Judas Priest being his favorites of the old masters. But it was such a small space that even a single item out of place made it feel cluttered and unlivable. It was only a sanctuary from daily life on the ship if he kept it spotless. He'd been to Tolvern's room once, and that was 2 years earlier, during a rare lull in the war, when they'd been able to celebrate Twelfth Night like civilians. Tolvern had acted as captain, and he'd played her cabin boy. He appeared dutifully at her door to escort her to the bridge. She'd cracked the door just enough to slip through sideways, but he'd caught a glimpse inside. Dirty clothes and dishes everywhere. Drawers hung out. The bed was unmade and askew in the room, and pictures of her parents, nieces and nephews, and the family dog had been tacked haphazardly to the walls. Half-read books lay spine up on her little desk.
"Captain Tolvern," he'd said in a tone of faux concern, "have you called the MP? It seems you were robbed during the night."
Now he looked her over more closely. Her eyes were red, with bags beneath them, and her hair was mussed and her uniform crumpled. One of the buttons of her vest was undone, and she had what looked like a grease stain on her pant leg, as if she'd eaten standing at the computer instead of in the mess.
"You should have called me earlier. You must be 15 hours over your shift." 18 and a half, she said. "I don't dare leave the bridge for more than 20 minutes. Afraid I'll come back to find a new regime in place."
"The problem with mutiny," Drake said, "is that when you've finished, you're left with a crew of mutineers." She grimaced.
"It's not the mutineers. Corporal Cap and the other prisoners worry me more. Her lover, that fellow Carvalho, I swear he's a pirate or I don't know the meaning of the word."
He cast a glance toward the bathroom, needing a hot shower, followed by several cups of even hotter tea. When he glanced back, Tolvern was stifling a huge yawn. The tea could wait, he decided. "Give me 5 minutes," he said. "Then you can brief me in the war room before I send you down. No, better yet, come talk to me while I get cleaned up." He went into the bathroom and turned the water to maximum heat in the hope that it would cut his headache, which was starting to return. Tolvern stood outside the bathroom while he showered, shouting into him what had occurred since the doctor drugged him up. While still in the Barca system, she'd received a message offering amnesty if Drake and his crew would surrender to the Royal Navy. She'd ignored the request, figuring that it was a trick, and continued to the jump point. They'd jumped to Phantalus, a system whose binary stars left its planets alternately boiling or frigid, and which was therefore uninhabited except for a few easily avoided outposts. They were now racing toward the next jump, on their way back to the Griffin Shoals. Tolvern didn't know where else to take them. Until they had their pilot back, they were stuck with what Cap could do, which was very little. Tolvern figured that they might be able to find someone to finish their repairs in the shoals. That was unlikely, Drake thought, though he didn't say this aloud. From what Tolvern reported about their damage, he figured they'd need at least a week in the yards, and about 20,000 pounds to complete the repairs. This was a military vessel. They had no money on board, except what pocket change could be found in possession of the crew. Drake thought he might have a few guineas and a couple of half-crowns, and doubted anyone else would do much better. Anyway, the operations in the Griffin Shoals were small-time. Ajax needed major shipbuilding prowess, and that meant Nib Pym in the pilot's chair. Unfortunately, the news wasn't good for the Hroom pilot. He'd only been an eater for a few weeks, and Drake had been under the impression that the relationship between Hroom addiction and detox proceeded in a non-linear fashion. A Hroom who'd been an eater for 5 years might need a decade to recover, but a Hroom who'd only been on the sugar a few weeks might only need a few days, if that. The pilot should already be pulling out of it. Drake told her this as he grabbed his towel and climbed out of the shower. He looked up from pulling on his underwear to see Tulvern casting a surreptitious glance at him from where she stood outside the bathroom. She met his gaze and looked away, blushing.
"Don't worry," he told her. "Doc checked me out, nothing else broken."
"What? Oh, well, I was wondering," she added quickly. "You slept long enough, but now that I've had a good look, you seem healthy enough, a few bruises."
"My apologies, Commander. I meant to get up earlier. I really did."
"Anyway," she continued as he came into the front room and grabbed his socks and shoes, "I'm wondering if someone is still feeding him sugar."
He gave her a sharp look.
"What do you mean?"
She told how she'd caught Carvalho and one of the other prisoners, a man she'd since discovered was named Lutz, standing outside the isolation cells, scheming.
"I went back down a couple of hours later to see if Nib Pym would be more reasonable, or if he tried to attack me again. He was twitching in the corner, wouldn't respond."
"Sugar swoon."
"Maybe," she said. "Or maybe that's a symptom of withdrawal. I asked Doc. He said either was possible."
"So you're thinking they got to Nib Pym, told him they'd bring him sugar if he..." "What exactly?"
She shrugged.
"Nib Pym might have promised all sorts of stuff to get his fix. Maybe he can deliver, maybe not. Smythe was able to pull up info on Carvalho. He was arrested for selling military supplies to civilians on the black market. This seems like something he'd do."
"We'll soon put an end to it."
"I already did. Lutz and Carvalho are in the brig. Took them at gunpoint myself."
That was a problem. On the one hand, Drake was furious that the two men would be undermining his attempts to get their pilot out of isolation and back where he belonged. Some captains, Rutherford came to mind, would have grabbed the man, had him whipped and his possessions searched, then dumped him out the airlock if anything turned up. Maybe in the heat of battle, Drake would have done the same thing. But now was not the heat of battle. Now he was short-handed.
"What about Cap?" he asked.
Tulvern looked proud of herself.
"I waited until she was off shift and asleep in her quarters before arresting her friend. She'll be up soon, though. I imagine we'll need to massage things. Carvalho is pretty mad. Lutz actually threatened me."
"We might need to release them."
"What? No, Captain."
"It's a delicate situation.
We barely have enough crew to fly. Cap might be Carvalho's lover. Imagine if she refuses to navigate. We're suddenly drifting helplessly through space with no way to jump."
She jutted out her chin.
"We'll find a way."
"The Phantalus system is as good as uninhabited. The closest settlement is 5 light-years away. The plasma engines top out at 12% light speed. I suppose we could send out a subspace distress signal and wait to see who shows up, but I doubt we'd like the result."
"And you think letting them go is the answer? I know what I saw."
"Then there are the other prisoners. What are they going to think if we throw their mates in the brig based on a suspicion?"
"The devil take them all. The sooner we dump these villains, the better."
"Agreed," he said. "But until then, we've got to work with the crew we've been given."
He didn't point out, though he'd been thinking it more or less continuously since the mutiny, that Tulvern's rash decision was the cause of this entire mess. If she'd done her duty, obeyed orders no matter where in the fleet they'd sent her, they wouldn't be running for their lives with a bare-bones crew with poor discipline and suspect loyalties. Except Drake was no longer certain the mutiny was a mistake. Well, Tulvern's motives were certainly mistaken, but some curious things had turned up. What had happened to Nib Pym was chief among his concerns, but he was also wondering why Rutherford had broken pursuit to go back and rescue the slaver. Drake had made the suggestion himself, but he hadn't expected the man to take the bait. In fact, he'd been fully prepared to surrender so as to save all those humans and Hroom. Did Rutherford truly break off to rescue the crippled ship? Or did he break off out of sympathy for his old friend? Drake couldn't decide. And then, there was the curious message offering a pardon if Ajax surrendered. Why would they do that? A trick to recover the cruiser, as Tolvern suggested? Surely Admiral Malthorn would never do such a thing. The man's pride wouldn't allow it, for one. For another, both Malthorn and Rutherford would know that Drake would recognize a bluff when he saw it. Discipline was so precarious in the lonely depths of space that mutiny must be put down with all violence. They would never offer amnesty. Unless... What if there had been something, or someone, on the slaver of critical importance? And now they thought he had it. He needed to speak to Nib Pym, and he couldn't do that until he had the man detoxed, and that meant imposing discipline on his broken, rebellious crew. Drake buttoned his jacket and told Jane to open all channels. Tolvern gave him a curious look. "This is Captain Drake speaking. All hands are to report at once for a shipwide meeting. If you are currently bleeding from a chest wound, or your finger on the button is the only thing preventing an engine meltdown, you may hail me with your excuse. Otherwise, you will appear on the bridge by 0445. Refusal of this order will be considered mutiny and treated accordingly." He ended the transmission. To Tolvern, he added, "Release the prisoners." Chapter 10. Drake stood in the center of the bridge with his hands clasped behind his back. The last person in the room was Carvalho, who wore a deep, angry scowl. He shot a poisonous glare at Tolvern, then cast a glance at Cap, who sat at the blacked-out nav computer, rotating her chair on its pivot and scratching idly at her lion tattoos. Barker stood near the door, by one of the bosuns and a young engineer. He had a computer in his palm, and he was surreptitiously glancing at it, seemingly unable to turn away from the repairs for even an instant. Smythe was doing the same over at his console, but for all Drake knew, the tech officer was playing Romans versus Soviets again. Even the cook wore a sauce-splattered apron and carried a ladle in hand, as if to make his own point about how critical his work was. Tolvern leaned against a cart she had wheeled in from the mess hall, and a few people pointed at it and whispered. Others were chatting idly amongst themselves, paying no attention to anyone or anything but their own petty concerns. The lack of discipline had infected the entire crew. That would change now. Drake pulled up a viewscreen. Nothing but deep space, an unfamiliar swath of bright, cold stars. Red, blue, yellow, orange. A glowing white shroud sliced along the Y-axis from their point of view, and to starboard lay the bruised purple smear of a vast nebula like a royal cloak covered with glowing diamonds and rubies. 37 hours until the next jump, he said. Most people stopped talking, but a few whispered conversations continued. In total, we are 3 days' travel from the nearest planet with a breathable atmosphere. He drew his gun and pointed it at Corporal Cap. The conversation died. Cap stiffened and stopped swiveling in the pilot's chair. If I shoot the corporal, we won't be able to find the jump point. He pointed the gun at Barker. If I kill the chief engineer, the damaged engines will melt down. Drake slid the gun back into its holster. He walked to his chair and sat down, then turned it to face them. He brought up his computer. If I initiate certain emergency protocols, our atmosphere will vent out. Right there, you have 3 people standing between you and death. But it goes deeper than that. Anyone in this room could kill himself and all of us. Push the wrong button, lean against an armed torpedo tube when it's closed. We're all gone. That was a bit of hyperbole. There were safeguards against random mental breakdowns and general dumbfoolery, but he had their attention now. And if that isn't enough, he continued, the might of the Royal Navy has turned its attention to us. They will blow us straight to hell if they can. One careless subspace message, and we might pop out of a jump point to find Dreadnought herself waiting to devour us. He gestured at the viewscreen, and all eyes went to it. That's the void. There's nothing out there but empty space. People seem to forget that. Carelessness, lack of discipline?
We're one false move from dying at any moment.
He nodded at Tulvern. On his insistence, she'd gone back to her room to change her jacket and brush her hair, and had come back gulping hot tea. She hardly looked fresh or well-rested, but she'd managed to feign something approaching alertness. Now she cast a glare across the room.
"Some of you don't seem to know your positions," Tulvern said, "and circumstances have forced changes in other areas. So that there can be no doubt, let us review them now."
She glanced at her hand computer.
"Chief Gunner Barker, you are now head of engineering as well. Oglethorpe has a brevet to sub-lieutenant, and you may assign him duties as you see fit. Manx."
She went through the list. The cook was now alone, as was Doc in medical. Nurses and assistant cooks were placed, temporarily at least, in more critical roles. Carvalho went to engineering, something mechanical that kept him away from critical systems. His fellow schemer Lutz would work with the bosuns on a shift schedule that kept the two men from overlapping their downtime. Carvalho's lover, Corporal Cap, would stay on the bridge, where the officers could keep an eye on her. Drake had more information on that score, but Tulvern didn't reveal that yet.
"Are there any questions?" Drake asked.
Cap waved her hand.
"Yeah, Captain, I got one." "Stand up when you address your captain," Tulvern snapped.
Cap rose from the chair.
"Excuse me, Commander Tulvern."
Too much emphasis on that last part to be sincere. Cap looked back to the captain.
"Do we have any sort of plan, Captain? Or are we just playing at Navy discipline here? They ain't gonna let us back in because we start salutin' and wearin' our uniforms all pressed and nice."
"I'm glad you asked that," Drake said. "We need repairs beyond what we can manage in transit. That means putting into a yard. Ideally, this would be a naval yard, but since that is impossible, it means going to one of the Ladino worlds, or maybe a new Dutch port, outside the control of the kingdom. It's likely to mean some non-standard tech."
Some of the more alert sorts, including both Cap and Carvalho, but also Barker, Smythe, and several others of the original crew, passed looks among themselves. How would they pay for such a thing? And why would they be cobbling on foreign tech if they didn't mean to keep flying around the sector, away from the fleet? No doubt many of them had already discussed these doubts privately. He didn't have answers yet, so before anyone could voice these questions, he pressed on.
"Corporal Cap, you've done well navigating us this far," he said. "I see no reason why the Navy refused your attempts to become a pilot."
Cap's eyes widened, and for the first time the slouch left her posture.
"But you have a good deal to learn. You're being promoted to sub-pilot and breveted to an officer, Ensign Level 2. You will train under Nib Pym when he returns to the bridge."
"But he's an eater. How am I supposed to—"
"He's not an eater. Someone trapped him, and I'm going to find out who. Meanwhile, he's going through detox. Commander?"
Drake nodded at Tulvern again. She opened the cart and took out several sacks of sugar, containing about 10 pounds each, together with a box containing sugar packets. The cook said this was all he had in the kitchen. It had been under lock and key. There were room in the fleet, after all, and plenty of sugar smuggling. Tulvern carried the sugar to the incinerator. The sacks were too big for the little chute on the bridge, so she tore them open and poured the sugar down it. Then she emptied the packets into the incinerator as well. "Naval regs prevent sugar being held privately," Drake said as she worked. "But I'm declaring an amnesty through the end of today. Turn it in to Commander Tulvern and there will be no consequences."
"No sugar at all," someone grumbled. "Not even in the kitchen.
The only room on board is in the bloody isolation cell," someone else said.
"We've got a little honey on board," Drake said. "Not much. We'll save it to sweeten tea. Cook tells me it will last about a week if rationed."
Several people grumbled or scowled at this.
"If I hear so much as a hint that someone has a secret stash, figuring what's the harm, it's not like I'm going to do anything bad with the stuff. The next step will be to put every last bit of tea on board down the incinerator. I'm as Albionish as anyone here. If I have to give up my tea, I will be very cranky. Heads will roll. As for the disgusting idea,
that someone might be giving sugar to our pilot? Let me say this. First, there will be a guard posted at all times. Unauthorized contact with Nib Pim is prohibited. If anyone is caught trying to pass sugar to Nib Pim, that person will be summarily executed. Am I understood?
Nobody has to be on this ship, Carvalho spoke up. You ever think about that? I wasn't even in the Navy. I was on a trade ship and hauled in because my captain was passing contraband. I didn't know nothing about it.
You are free to leave at any time, Drake said. We have an away pod. I can fire you off and you can see if anyone responds to your distress call. You and any other malcontents. I'll strap you in myself if that's what you want.
So death or slavery, that's the choice you're offering.
Obey orders, and I'll leave you at the first safe port. It's likely to be a Ladino world. Then you can do whatever you'd like. Until then, I will have discipline on this ship.
Tolvern had finished dumping the sugar and now came to confront Carvalho where he stood.
Can you do that, Carvalho, or should I return you to the brig?
He stared at her a long moment, his expression hard.
Fine.
Good, Drake said. You're all dismissed. We have a lot of work to do. Ensign, Cap. We seem to have drifted. Get us back on course.
Aye, Captain,
she said, and there was real energy in her voice. She didn't look at Carvalho, which was precisely Drake's intent. He needed her until he had Nib Pim back. He didn't have much use for Carvalho. The rest of them filed out. Drake took Tolvern by the arm as she made her way to her computer. You, Commander, are off duty.
I thought I'd check the security system down by the isolation cells, make sure the cameras are active, and verify that Nib Pim is still locked up. Then I told Barker I'd meet with him about the engine. He has a possible fix he wants to run by me.
You are off duty.
But, Captain...
Commander, he said, voice firm. I'll see you again at 1300. Is that understood?
Yes, sir.
In spite of her earlier protest, there was real relief in her voice. As she disappeared from the bridge, he thought about his crew. All commoners. Even the ship doctor, a profession normally derived from the better sorts of society, was not from Drake's class. The man hadn't grown up on Albion, but one of the outer colonies. Never mind the prisoners, even considering what remained of Ajax's original crew raised questions. Tolvern had sent off anyone who wouldn't participate in the mutiny. It was no coincidence that the people who'd left were of a generally higher quality than those who had stayed. That was if one only considered their station in life. The ones who stayed are the loyal ones. Drake pushed this thought out of his head and made his way to his captain's chair. He waited until Cap glanced in his direction.
Did you say you know a closer jump point than the one that will take us back toward the shoals?
Aye, Captain, 14 hours closer.
Roughly a day's journey.
23 hours, yeah.
She looked a little nervous.
Can't say as I'd recommend it.
There's a star, is that right?
Aye. You're in the grav well of a star. You gotta pivot, accelerate, and execute another jump in less than 2 hours. Tough to do when you're fighting the trips.
I think I've done this jump. A red dwarf, isn't it? It's murder going through two jumps back to back like that. But the jump itself didn't seem too technically difficult.
Thing is, she said, swallowing hard, her typical bravado missing. I only seen it done once, and I wasn't the pilot.
I only saw it done once, too, he said. We were jumping to San Pablo. You know the world? Room on one continent, humans on the other. Mostly Ladino and Dutch.
Yeah. I spent a week in the port, rough place.
Good space yards, though. And it's on the frontier, which means the Albion fleet can't enter, according to the treaty. Can you make the jump?
I don't know the angle. And that close to the star, there's some funny gravity effects. The jump point wobbles. If we mess up, if I come out of the first jump in a bad way...
I have faith in you, pilot.
Thing is, I'm not really a pilot. You said I could train.
Yes, and you will. In fact, I don't intend for you to execute this jump alone. I've got a full day.
Technically 23 hours.
Plus a couple of hours from the first jump to the second. More than a day, in fact. Nib Pim hasn't been an eater for long, so if we can keep him from the sugar...
What do you know about that? Anyone feeding him?
Don't know what you mean. I didn't have nothing to do with that.
She seemed to catch herself and added belatedly,
I mean, sir.
But you might know someone who did. Someone feeding him sugar. Someone who might still do it. Maybe you could put out the word. We're going to do a jump that might tear us into individual atoms if we don't get it right. It would be helpful to have our pilot off the sugar by then. Barring that, he wondered if he should have kept back a bit of sugar just in case. The only thing worse than an eater piloting your ship was an eater on withdrawal doing it. Give the room some sugar, wait for the swoon to pass, then sit him in the chair and hope he had enough functioning brain cells to do the job. No choice now. Drake had made the decision. There might not be another grain left on board. If there were, he hoped it was getting dumped quietly down the incinerator at this very moment.
I don't know nobody who gave him sugar, Cap said. But just in case, I'll put out the word. Never hurts for people to know what's serious, if you know what I mean.
He'd already declared that anyone passing sugar to Nib Pym would be summarily executed. Would it really take word from Cap before anyone took that seriously? If so, who was really in charge of this ship? Chapter 11. 10 hours after Drake sent her from the bridge, Tolvern felt almost human again as she joined her captain at the front of the isolation block. The guard shifted his shotgun to one shoulder and saluted with his free hand.
"Any trouble?" Tolvern asked.
"No, ma'am. He was raving pretty good last night, but a few hours ago we passed in food and he ate it. Even pushed the bowl and plate back through the chute."
"That's good news," she said. "What did he have?"
"Hot oatmeal, 2 raw eggs, usual room breakfast."
"And he ate it all?"
she asked, surprised.
"Every last bit. Even asked for more, but Doc said he shouldn't overdo it since he hasn't been eating for so long."
"What do you think about that?"
Tolvern said to Drake as the two of them walked to the cell with the green light over the door.
"That's a good sign, right, Captain? I think he's going to pull out of it."
"No chipper this morning," he said.
"Feeling great. Nobody's trying to kill me for one."
"You just got on shift. Give it a few minutes."
"Ha!"
It wasn't the relative safety of their current position that had improved her mood so much as the 9 glorious hours of sleep. She'd followed them with a scalding shower and a full breakfast of scrambled eggs, buttered toast, sausage and fried tomatoes, washed down with an entire pot of tea. Over the past few days, she'd been feeling more and more glum, worried that she'd made a terrible life-ending mistake in seizing Ajax from Rutherford to free her captain. But this morning, she was more convinced than ever that Drake had been innocent all along, that he had enemies who had framed him. He would be exonerated soon enough. Drake cupped his hands at the window, then stepped aside to let her have a look. She peered into the cell. Nib Pym sat on the floor facing the corner opposite his cot, his knees tucked to his chest. He'd finally stripped out of the rags they'd found him in on the slave ship and put on a pair of trousers. There was a shirt, too, but it sat on the floor, and the room was bare from the waist up, his back to them. He didn't have the faded pink color of an eater, nor that starved, rib-showing look like the room she'd seen on the bridge of Henry Upton. But there was something disturbing about the way he sat there, motionless. While she watched, a shiver worked itself down his spine and turned into a shudder as it hit his limbs. She stepped away from the window and reached out to open the door.
"Better stand back, sir, just in case."
"You don't have to tell me. My head is still aching from last time."
The captain had come armed, not with his standard sidearm, but with a stun gun at his hip. He now unlatched the holster and flicked on the gun. It whirred to life. Tolvern put her hand on the pad, and the door slid open. Nib Pym didn't turn.
"Pilot," Drake said.
He took the first step into the room, and Tolvern had a hard time not grabbing his shoulder to pull him back to safety.
"Lieutenant Nib Pym, it's me, your captain."
The room's high melodic voice had a hollow sound to it.
"Did you bring sugar?"
"There will be no more sugar, pilot. We dumped it down the incinerator,"
There isn't a grain left on the ship. A hoot, which passed for a laugh, came from the room.
Or so you think.
Tolver now came in. She'd undone the strap on her own weapon. This one was loaded with bullets, and she was prepared to shoot if necessary.
We know about Carvalho and Lutz, she said. Captain said anyone caught passing you sugar would be killed. Guess that did it for them. Lutz handed over 2 pounds of the stuff.
2 pounds?
There was something sinister in the room's tone, and his body tensed.
Don't even think about it, she warned. That crap went down the incinerator with the rest of it. This ship is clean.
Maybe, maybe not.
Nevertheless, Nib Pim's body relaxed. He still had his long legs drawn to his chest, his back turned. How are you feeling? Drake asked. Can we trust you? Another hooting laugh. It shortly died. Nobody spoke for a long moment. Tolvern was beginning to think they should give it another day or so, except Drake had already changed course, and they were going toward the jump point that would bring them out within the gravity well of a red dwarf. They didn't have time to straighten this out. They needed the pilot to snap out of it in a hurry.
They always tell you, Nib Pim said after a moment. One taste on the tongue, that's all it takes. You hear it, you see the fools who've sold their souls into slavery, who have degraded our ancient and glorious civilization and everything it stood for. But you tell yourself that this may be true for the weak-willed, not for you.
So that's why you did it? Tolvern asked. How could he have done something so stupid? He'd always been the most sensible person on the ship, save the captain. To prove you were different?
I wasn't so deluded as that. My brother became an eater, together with most of my village, my parents too. I saw what it could do when I was still a roomling. Once my family was destroyed, they shipped me off with human missionaries, who never let me near the stuff.
That's exactly what I thought, Drake said, sounding relieved. I knew you must have been tricked somehow. For her part, Tolvern was more confused than ever.
But how is it that you didn't recognize what was happening? It's only pure white sugar that does it. Mix it with something, even dissolve it in water, and sucrose is no more dangerous than any other sweet substance. It's only the pure stuff that sets you off. So how did you possibly put some in your mouth without knowing?
And when you did, Drake added, why didn't you go straight to the sickbay for treatment? You must have recognized what was happening the instant it hit your tongue. You must have known you'd been poisoned.
I wasn't poisoned.
You know what he means, Tolvern said. Same thing, isn't it? You were a pilot of a Royal Navy cruiser before you tasted it. A few days later, you were a slave.
I wasn't poisoned,
Nib Pim insisted,
because I ate the sugar of my own free volition.
What?
The word exploded from her mouth.
King's balls, why would you do such a thing?
And I did so. Knowing slavery would be the result, indeed that was my intent all along.
The captain looked stunned.
Are you mad?
Tolvern said.
It's a curious thing, Nib Pim said. They have slaves to work the sugar wells, millions of them, and millions more needed. A place like Hot Bassa is too steamy, too tropical, riddled with disease. Humans die, Hroom die too, but we're expendable. They can always ship in more. They need so many of us because the demand for sugar is endless. The more sugar they ship, the more slaves they need. The more room that become enslaved, the more sugar they need. An endless circle, like a snake biting its own tail.
Why did you do this to yourself? The captain asked.
I didn't set out to. I set out to prove you innocent. I got into the computer, sure that whoever destroyed that York Company clipper was the culprit, that you had been framed.
Yeah, we all figured that, Tolvern said.
Nib Pim unfolded himself from the floor. She braced herself for another charge like the one yesterday, but this time he moved shakily to the cot. His limbs were trembling, and he closed his big liquid eyes for a long moment, as if fighting a bout of vertigo. He opened his eyes again.
But we all assumed it had been an accident,
Nib Pim continued.
that some other captain had mistakenly destroyed the company ship and cast about for someone to blame. I found archival footage of the battle before it was doctored to show Ajax doing the attack. It was clear that the attack was intentional. The Clipper tried to surrender.
Who did it? Drake asked.
A small unmarked pirate ship carrying Royal Navy ordnance.
Tolvern was growing excited at this. Something was rotten in the Navy. They weren't in mutiny so much as trying to track down illegal behavior within the fleet. As soon as Malthorn knew the truth, they would be vindicated. If the Lord Admiral wouldn't act, Drake could take matters straight to the King.
The pirate ship sent a boarding party, the pilot continued. They removed something from the merchant ship. Upon their return, they ordered the Clipper to stand by with shields down, and then they fired a full broadside. There were no survivors.
Drake cocked his head in that distinctive way that said he was getting something through the comlink tucked into his ear. After a moment, he turned to Tolvern.
We are needed on the bridge. There's another ship.
Her pulse quickened at this. She glanced at Nib Pym, then back to the captain. What about him?
We're approaching a jump point, Drake said to the Froom. Things get tricky after the jump. I could sure use you on the bridge.
Nib Pym was still sitting on the edge of the cot, and now grabbed for his shirt. He looked toward the still open door that led to the corridor as he unfolded the shirt. But then he stopped and set the shirt back down.
It's not safe, Captain.
Are you a threat? Drake asked, his tone measured.
I thought about getting back to the chair, and then I thought about certain crew members who'd slipped me sugar earlier, and I started thinking about how I'd get to them.
I knew it, Tolvern said, face flushing. What did I tell you, Captain? Was it Carvalho and Lutz? She asked the room.
Time enough for that later, Drake said. Stay here for now, he told Nib Pym. But we're coming up on the jump point. Meditate, pray to your gods. Whatever it takes, I need you with me, and I need you clean and sober.
He grabbed Tolvern and the two of them backed into the corridor and closed the door to the cell. She followed the captain past the guard, reluctant to leave, even under imminent threat. More questions now than ever. What the devil had been on that merchant clipper? It had been flying under the Albion Lions. It was a high crime to disturb her passage, let alone destroy her with all hands lost. Then to pin her destruction on Captain Drake? And whatever Nib Pym had learned made him become an eater of his own free will? That made no sense. They had more immediate concerns as they reached the bridge. Smythe sat at his computer, hands flying over the controls and occasionally tapping the screen as he brought up various images. Cap paced back and forth in front of the pilot's chair, rubbing her hands together.
You see?
Cap cried when she spotted them. She pointed at the viewscreen. A dark, shadowy form slid across the screen, its outline blurred and shifting, as the long-range sensors attempted to pull it into focus. It was still a million miles away, but it had the profile of a warship.
Calm down, Drake told the young woman, as he took his place in the captain's chair. It's flying away from us at the moment, not engaging. No doubt it's on its way to the same jump point as we are.
Jane, Tolvern said, taking her own seat next to him. Give us the specs. Jane's cool, clear voice came through.
Ship identification unknown, unregistered. Hull is a heavy frigate, provenance New Dutch, Van Dyke class, with deck and hull modifications. Engine signature, Ladino. Weapons detected, 6 torpedo tubes in Mark IV array. 3 kinetic cannons, these being roughly...
Enough, Drake interrupted. We get the gist.
Indeed, New Dutch hull with Ladino engines. Torpedo tubes in a Royal Navy configuration, but with a non-standard number of cannon. And it was hauling toward the same chancy jump point out of the system. Nothing legit, but this was no small-scale smuggler either. This was a pirate frigate.
What do you think, Commander? Drake asked Tolvern. Coincidence? I didn't expect to run into someone way out here beyond Phantalus's gas giants.
Yes, I think coincidence, she said. On their way out of the system after doing Well, whatever ugly business they were about. If we were any smaller, they'd turn on us. But they'd be a fool to tangle with a cruiser of our size and strength.
We could ignore her. Hold back, let her make the jump, then come in after her.
By now they've identified our ship class, at least, Tolvern said. And if the pirates don't know we're outlaws ourselves, they'll be pissing themselves trying to get to that jump point in time.
I've got it! Smythe exclaimed, looking up from his computer. It's the Captain Kidd. Plasma signature matches exactly.
Captain Kidd? That didn't mean anything to Tolvern, except as the name of the old Earth pirate. But Ajax hadn't been in the position of hunting down pirate ships. They'd been off warring against real enemies for the past 2 years.
Fairly notorious, Drake said. He apparently knew more than she did. Captain Kidd mixed it up with HMS Richmond last year. Richmond got the worst of it.
Tolvern didn't think much of Richmond or her crew, but it showed that this pirate ship wasn't afraid to tackle solitary ships of the Royal Navy. She'd have relished the thought of bagging the prize under other circumstances, but after the mauling at the hands of Vigilant a couple of days earlier, she was no longer so confident. What if the pirates weren't pissing themselves, but preparing to circle around and give battle? What would Ajax be worth? She'd make a terrific pirate ship in the wrong hands. Surely the pirate captain wouldn't be so foolish as to make the attempt.
Tolvern? Drake said.
I hate to linger in the system, she said. For all we know, Vigilant spotted us jumping out of Barca and came after us. And if Rutherford has called for reinforcements, we might be facing a full task force in a day or two.
We're not exactly ready for battle against the pirates either, he said. Are there any other jump points we can find in the system?
We can't let the pirates get away,
Cap said, her voice high and excited.
What if they've heard of us? They'd sell us out to the fleet, you know they would.
That was one more good point, Tolvern conceded, even as she was irritated that the sub-pilot was speaking out of place.
That only matters if we stay in the system, Drake said. Once we're gone, it doesn't matter if we've been identified or not.
Captain Kidd is accelerating, Smythe said.
What's her jump speed at estimated mass?
Tolvern asked.
0.082, plus or minus 1,000.
Slower than us, sir, she told the captain.
That was a chancy assumption. The speed needed to jump through space was a function of the mass and shape of the ship and how tight or loose the jump point itself was. It was not altogether linear, and of course there were other factors involved than jump speed in how one might select engine power. A pirate ship might have larger than required engines so that it could outrun other vessels, either to overtake them in attack or flee when overmatched. But Ajax had been built with similar considerations.
Bring us up to 0.06, Drake said. Let's see what Captain Kidd does.
Tolvern thumbed the command on her console. Moments later, Barker called up from the engine rooms, as she'd known he would, demanding to know why she'd called for more power to the engines. They were still a long way out from the jump. She told him the situation. He grumbled at this.
Put Barker on the bridge channel, Drake said.
She obeyed. The engineer's gravelly voice came through for the others to hear.
Captain, you there? I don't care for the thought of another fight so soon, and I'm not afraid to say it.
Explain yourself, Barker, Drake said.
Don't need much explaining. Shields won't stand the abuse, and I could use about 10 more crew down here for the weapon systems.
We're not fighting Vigilant, Drake said. It's a pirate ship.
Barker grunted.
I know it, and if this were Vigilant, I'd say it was suicide, but pirates or no, I don't care for it one bit.
So we're incapable of fighting, Drake asked. Is that what you're telling me?
Now Barker sounded more hesitant.
I wouldn't go so far as to say that.
We need your exact status, Tolvern said.
She understood that the captain appreciated an unvarnished opinion, but the engineer's equivocating grated on her.
Can you fight or not?
Barker grunted.
Well, guns are back on their carriages, and we have sufficient ordnance for a fight, so long as it doesn't carry on too long. Responses will be sluggish given how we're undermanned.
We are 1,000,000 miles out, Drake said. There's a bit of time yet. But get your men and women out of bed, anyone you need. I want you on full standby in 10 minutes.
Yes, sir.
There's another consideration, Tolvern told the captain when Barker was offline. We've been racing around for a couple weeks now without putting into port. The scoops have been collecting hydrogen while we're at cruising speed, but it hasn't replaced more than 15% of what we're burning. We accelerate to jump speed now, and we might be running on fumes in a few days.
Yes, I'm aware of that possibility, Drake said. We might come limping into San Pablo.
Captain Kidd is accelerating, Smythe said. She's trying to outrun us.
Just what I thought, Drake said with a smile. There was something cunning in that smile, and Tolvern suddenly knew that she wasn't privy to all his thoughts. He was scheming. That he had any sort of plan at all gave her renewed hope. Hail the ship, Drake said. I have a proposal to put to our pirate friends.
Chapter 12. Captain Nigel Rutherford took Vigilant down through Albion's atmosphere. The ship shuddered and bucked, like an unbroken horse with a rider on its back. He stared out the window at the surface as it came rushing up. The continent of Britain peeled away from Australia, and soon he could see mountains, lakes, and rivers resolving themselves. Finally, the wide, fertile York Plain, golden with autumn wheat, from horizon to horizon. The plain ended at Lake Huron, the nearest of the Great Lakes. It was daytime, and there was cloud cover to the east, so he didn't immediately pick out Yorktown. Then he saw the skyscrapers of the Kingdom Towers in the center of the city, the downtown area curving in an arc along the banks of the St. Lawrence, with bridges running back and forth across the river. The Royal Palace and its vast estates lay between the west bank of the river and the forests stretching to a distant mountain range on the north. It was a huge wooded parkland, almost the size of the city itself, thousands upon thousands of acres. The Punisher-class cruisers were the largest naval ships capable of landing planetside. Unlike a carrier, or the great battleship Dreadnought, which was built to brawl with enemies in space, Vigilant and her sister ships Ajax and Churchill were occasionally called on to engage air forces inside a planet's atmosphere. They could disgorge marines in the middle of a hostile city while bombarding the enemy with cannon and missile, a laser tracing a scorching ray back and forth until the city was aflame. But it took a hardened carbon fiber and pterillium surface to withstand the tremendous heat of her plasma engines upon takeoff and landing. Had he attempted to land at York's commercial port, he'd have melted the tarmac, and so Rutherford ordered them to approach from the south, toward the military spaceport, some 30 miles distant from the palace and 50 miles outside the city. A strange, unpleasant sensation settled deep in Rutherford's bones as the ship powered down upon landing, the pull and tug of natural gravity for the first time in months. In space, the anti-grav systems kept the bones from eroding, but real gravity was a different sensation. It felt like his bones were shifting in place. You're going to feel some serious shifting if you're not careful. His bones might shift right out of their sockets when they hoisted him by his wrists for a flogging. His neck bones might shift when he dangled from a rope a noose about his throat. Rutherford stepped onto the tarmac, where the air was so hot that it seemed to suck the breath from his lungs. It radiated through his boots, nearly cooking his feet inside. Only gradually did the crisp autumn breeze drive away the heat left by Vigilant's engines. It carried the scent of forest, something he hadn't smelled in a long time, but that seemed so green and welcoming, he thought a desire for it must be written into his very DNA. A military vehicle painted the red and gold of Albion came rolling toward where he stood. As ordered, he was alone, without so much as a staff officer to accompany him. He'd told Pittsfield that the crew had been commanded to go through standard decontamination procedures. Pittsfield's raised eyebrow showed how much he believed that particular story. They hadn't been planetside, so there was no point in decontamination. The vehicle pulled to a stop, and two naval police officers jumped out. They had sidearms and grim expressions. The lead man saluted, which eased Rutherford's fears that he was under arrest. Nevertheless, he was hardly at ease, given the circumstances.
"Captain Rutherford?"
"Yes,"
Come along, the Admiral is waiting.
Once he was inside the lorry, it raced across the tarmac toward the gates of the spaceport. There were guard towers and checkpoints, but they were not challenged and soon reached the open road beyond. The lorry joined civilian traffic for a stretch, then turned onto another military road. A maglev rushed by to their left, the entire train appearing and vanishing in an instant. After driving through the countryside for about an hour, they passed through a small town of two-story red brick houses, each tucked one against the other, before turning onto a country lane. A gate soon blocked their passage. The driver showed his credentials, and an armed guard opened the gate and waved them through. They drove another 20 minutes through a large estate with fields, stables, and a pair of tenant villages, tidy but modest, and then drove through another checkpoint before they approached the manor house itself. Sitting on a rise at the heart of Lord Malthorne's estate, the manor was like a small palace itself, with two huge wings spreading out from the looming central part of the house to embrace a courtyard. Walled gardens and carefully cultivated woodland walks stretched toward a small artificial lake. A small island lay in the center, topped by what looked like a Greek temple. Beyond the lake lay a vast woodland, which also belonged to the Lord Admiral. The property was some 100,000 acres, but Rutherford knew it was only a fraction the size of the vast sugar plantations Malthorne held on Hot Barsa and Satum. The naval police sent Rutherford out of the lorry and walking toward the front door, while they remained behind. He stood alone at the 10-foot double-oak doors, and when they didn't open of their own accord, lifted the brass knocker and let it fall with a boom. A butler in coat and tails gestured him into a vast open foyer with a curved marble staircase sweeping to the second floor. Then another elegantly dressed servant brought him into a two-story library that smelled of pipe smoke and old books. He accepted an offer of tea and sat next to a large globe of old earth. He turned it idly while sipping his tea, noting how comically small were the original British islands that all Albionish claimed as their ancestral home. At least some of the other homelands, America, Canada, and Australia, looked like they had some heft to them.
"It is beautiful," Admiral Malthorne said, coming into the room. "The most beautiful planet you will ever see."
Rutherford sprang to his feet and saluted.
"Old Earth. There was some sort of war, wasn't there?" "King Hubert used to dream of sending a fleet back to the home system. Unite all of humanity."
It wasn't an answer to Rutherford's question.
"His son is more practical. We have troubles enough in our own neighborhood without setting off on fanciful adventures."
"Have you been, my lord?"
"Yes, I have. Or to the Earth system, anyway. I never landed on Earth itself."
Malthorne took the opposite chair. The globe sat atop a small oak-accent table, and the Admiral now opened its drawer and pulled out a pipe and a tin of tobacco. He pressed tobacco into the pipe, packed it with a silver temper, then finished filling it. A moment later he was puffing. Before Vigilant's final approach, Rutherford had taken care to have his dress uniform ironed. He'd put on his ribbons and tassels and made sure the buttons on his vest were polished. He greased his hair and parted it in the middle. Current fashion was a close-shaved head, but the officers of the Royal Navy were more conservative, and he was glad he'd been too pressed to cut it recently. It fell in slick curls over his ears. But now he felt overdressed. The Admiral was not in uniform at all, but wore a smoking jacket and riding trousers with polished knee-high boots. He had the look of a man who had stopped in for a quick pipe before changing his jacket and taking his horse and dogs out for a hunt.
"It was about 20 years ago, Malthorne continued between puffs. "The King sent me with a task force to see the lay of the land, so to speak. It's no easy journey. There's a vast, lawless swath of systems between here and there, plus a star going nova to get around. We fought off pirates and petty warlords. One chartered jump had collapsed, and we ran out of fuel getting to the next. Becalmed for 3 weeks while we scooped hydrogen. Rations ran low, not helped by an infestation of rats. It was only when we had resorted to eating the little blighters that we put down the infestation.
Rutherford had never heard of this expedition.
What did you discover, my lord?
At Earth?
Malthorn smiled.
That is classified.
I see. And now the Admiral's face hardened.
You failed, Captain. And failed badly.
Rutherford looked down at his tea. The mug was cooling in his hands.
Yes, my lord.
Drake has escaped again. You destroyed Henry Upton against direct orders.
No, my lord, I never received them until it was too late. We returned at once. The ship broke apart before we could haul her in.
Which would not have been a problem if you had defeated Ajax to begin with.
My lord!
Malthorn waved his hand dismissively.
I've read the report, seen the footage. You had Ajax in your grasp. Her shields were down. You could have finished her easily.
But that's when you ordered me to turn around.
I grow weary of your excuses, Captain. You were given excellent information. You knew how to trap the enemy. Yet you still failed.
Rutherford sat silently stewing at this. He hadn't been given information. Those were things he'd figured out for himself. What's more, Malthorn had sent away the fleet before the engagement. The intention had been to lure Drake into a trap. In reality, it helped the man escape.
It was only a slaver, Rutherford said. I don't think it's any great loss.
Oh, you don't? Then it's a good thing your duty is not to think but to obey.
What was the Admiral going on about? Since when was a captain of the Royal Navy not allowed to think? It's why he'd thrashed the Hroom sloops of war at Epis III, and again in the Battle of Kif Lagoon. In that second engagement, he and Drake had been outnumbered 4-1 by the enemy. But the Hroom commanders had been ponderous, inflexible. When conditions changed, the two Albion captains had more deftly altered their battle plans and won a smashing victory as a result.
Was there something important about that particular slaver? Rutherford asked. Besides Drake's pilot being on board, I mean.
Yes, obviously.
Rutherford waited for the Admiral to elaborate, but the man sat brooding without speaking. Pipe smoke wreathed his scowling face. Rutherford was growing more confused by the minute. If whatever the slaver carried was so important, why had it been traveling without an escort? Why had Malthorn sent off the naval resources in the Barca system? They could have come in to rescue Henry Upton while Vigilant chased down and destroyed Ajax. For that matter, why summon Rutherford to the Malthorn estates? Why not speak on the Admiral's flagship in orbit? Or bring down the young captain himself while leaving Vigilant in space? Never mind. That wasn't his responsibility. Thinking in the moment, yes, but questioning naval strategy... No, that was not his duty.
I've been turning my thoughts to what Drake might do next, Rutherford said hesitantly.
Yes?
The other man's tone was dull, disinterested.
He has his pilot, according to survivors from Henry Upton, this particular room.
There were survivors. Why was this not in the report?
I didn't think it worth mentioning, my lord. We took fewer than 20 on board, and most were Hroom. I sent them on to Hot Barca, together with the wreckage.
Now Malthorn sat up straight.
How much wreckage?
2 big chunks of the hull. The engines seemed like they could be salvaged, and I thought the York Company would want their logs and the like. It was probably a waste of time, but...
Malthorn sprang to his feet and hurried from the room. Rutherford stared at the Admiral's pipe, smoldering on its tray where the man had left it. Now that was curious. Whatever or whoever had been on that ship sure had the Admiral agitated. Malthorn returned a few minutes later, seemingly calmer. He took his seat and relit the pipe, which had gone out in his absence.
"Excuse me,"
he said, with no further explanation for his behavior.
"Tell me, where has your old friend gone now?"
"Drake," Rutherford said. "Assuming he doesn't intend to surrender or abandon his ship and hide, and I see no evidence that he will do either of those things, then he has got to set about repairing his ship. And I imagine Drake will see to it that his room pilot gets off the sugar."
Once Anita, always Anita, Malthorn said.
Perhaps I've seen them detoxed. In any event, I have to think that Drake will go to heroic efforts. He risked his life for a reason.
He has managed to jump about without his pilot so far.
I looked into that, Rutherford said. It seems that one of the liberated prisoners was a former merchant pilot, a certain Corporal Cap. Maybe Drake used her to get to the Barza system, but her abilities would be limited. Drake needs Nib Pym back in the chair.
Supposing he manages to detox the room, what then? Where is the best place for a renegade to get repairs?
The Griffin Shoals, maybe.
Rutherford shook his head as he gave it additional thought.
No, not for Ajax. The yards would be wholly inadequate. They'd need something big. A naval yard, something in Ladino or New Dutch space. Or one of the Homeworlds. Of course, he'd need money, too.
Money? Yes, that is a good point.
I'd say Ladino, maybe Argentina or San Pablo. Peruano also has decent yards. The governor there would probably turn a blind eye to a renegade Albion ship.
Then I'll send Vigilant at the head of a task force, Malthorn said. Let's say I give you Richmond and Nimitz, Calypso too, plus a few destroyers and torpedo ships, enough that you can divide your forces as needed and still have the firepower to handle Ajax.
It wasn't firepower that concerned Rutherford, it was command. These ships, the Admiral mentioned, were captained by overly cautious men and women, not the type to outwit James Drake. He'd have rather named his own task force with superior command, but these ships were the ones Malthorn would have chosen had he been venturing out with the mighty Dreadnought, commanded by those who were loyal to the Admiral. Malthorn fixed him with a penetrating gaze.
Is that a problem?
No, Lord Admiral, that should be sufficient.
He wanted to ask about the strange reaction over the slaver wreckage, or why Malthorn had ordered Vigilant brought planetside. After consideration, he decided not to press.
Very well. You have your orders.
It was early evening when the naval police drove Rutherford off the Malthorn estate. When they were passing through the estate village, the lorry slowed to wait for a group of laborers trudging across the road behind a large tractor. The tractor itself was driven by a human, but curiously, the workers were all Hroom, tall and slender. Hroom were a tropical people, and wore jackets against the chill autumn air. As the lorry drove past, a Hroom with a pack and chemical sprayer met Rutherford's gaze through the window. The worker's face was a pale pink, his eyes glazed. An eater, a slave. Rutherford turned away, frowning and unsettled. It was not illegal to bring slaves to Albion, although Rutherford had heard grumbles that the Hroom were upsetting the long-established relationship between the land-owning class and free labor, at least in the countryside. He was sure his father would never do such a thing, or any of the landowners of Canada. They were a conservative, almost reactionary people in the Western Hemisphere, especially in the higher classes. And while he didn't agree with his father's views on many things, in this case, he wondered if the Baron Rutherford might not be correct. Not that the captain was afraid of Hroom. He'd had them in his crew, and they were intelligent and diligent, so long as you kept them from sugar. Even eaters didn't bother him. In larger numbers, Empire Hroom with fleets and firearms might be a threat, but not eaters. So long as the sugar kept coming, they were as docile as hunting hounds. His thoughts turned again to Drake's pilot and the destroyed slave ship itself. So much fuss over so little. He couldn't see the point of it. Soon they arrived at the military spaceport. Vigilant sat on the tarmac, a long, hungry, wolf-like form. It looked enormous from this vantage, surrounded by small support vehicles, with work crews going over the shields, and men climbing inside the 20-foot-high exhaust ports off the back engines. Inside the ship, unfamiliar men and women were moving about the corridors. He assumed at first that they were technicians and other workers giving the ship an interior tune-up to match what the Navy crews were performing on the outside. It was only when he reached the bridge and saw unfamiliar faces in the pilot's chair, at the tech officer's console, and even in the signal officer's chair, that he reconsidered. What the blazes? Commander Pittsfield was still there, thank God. He was scowling, his arms crossed. His gaze met Rutherford's, and he shook his head. Rutherford now understood why Malthorn had ordered him to land at the spaceport, and why he'd been summoned personally to the Lord Admiral's estate. That way he hadn't been around to complain while they replaced most of his crew. Chapter 13. Drake kept the view tight, so the pirate captain couldn't see his bridge. No sense letting the other man spot the empty chairs. He sat sprawled casually, as if this sort of business were typical. Jane whispered information about Captain Kidd in his ear. The man appearing on the other side looked the part. He had long braided hair turning gray at the temples. A scar curved around his left eye. A long aquiline nose dominated his face, which was adorned with gold hoops in his ears and gold beads on the drooping ends of his mustache, which draped over a braided beard. An attractive young woman stood at the shoulder of the pirate captain, staring through the screen with a sharp gaze. She had dark hair in a bob, and she wore a tight jumpsuit with a red skull emblazoned across the chest. The jumpsuit was unzipped enough to show cleavage, and there was a ruby pendant the size of a bloody eyeball between her breasts. At first, Drake thought her the captain's wife or mistress, but as she leaned in to whisper in the older man's ear, he noted a similarity between them. His daughter, Drake thought. Another person passed through the view of the pirate bridge. This one was a Hroom, his skin the native mottled reddish-orange, not an eater. Jane spoke in Drake's ear.
"Captain Pete Vargas," she said. "Illegitimate captain of the so-called Captain Kidd. Known felon, wanted dead or alive by the Royal Navy."
Was there something disapproving in her voice, or was that Drake's imagination? "Captain Vargas," Drake said with a smile, as if he'd known the name already. "The pirate who gave Richmond so much trouble. Seems your past has caught up with you."
"We're no pirates," the man said with a grunt. "We were in uncharted space when Richmond attacked us unprovoked. What do you want? An apology for damaging her while we fought for our lives?" "Very well. I am terribly sorry for any misunderstanding."
"What is your cargo?"
"None of your business."
"Is it valuable? I'd hate to destroy it without knowing first what it is."
"Bring it on," the other captain blustered. "I'll give Richmond a whipping and I'll do the same to you. Put you down like a mad dog."
Drake smiled. "Doubtful. Have you ever heard of the Battle of Ypres III? This ship single-handedly forced the surrender of 3 Hroom sloops of war. I'm sure I could manage your rickety piece of rubbish with little trouble."
"Not today you won't. I can see your shields. You took a beating in some kind of fight, probably out of ammo too, am I right? I'm no idiot. You're trying to take me on pure swagger."
Drake's thumb moved. "Barker, show our friends the Crotalus battery." The external view screen flared white. When it resolved focus again, 2 missiles streaked away from Ajax. They accelerated rapidly, but it would take time to overtake Captain Kidd at her current speed.
3 minutes to impact, Jane said.
"I can call them off," Drake said. "Or I can fire more, if this is not sufficient. I have plenty, as you'll soon see."
As per Vargas's sneering remark, some of this was, in fact, swagger, but not all of it. They'd done precious little shooting since the mutiny. The shields were in rough shape, but they had more than sufficient firepower.
"My shields can take it," Vargas said, though there was something else in his voice. Uncertainty, perhaps. "What do you want? You're a fool if you think we'll surrender. Those missiles hit, then I'll give you one hell of a fight."
Drake leaned back in his chair, waiting.
"Well?" Vargas demanded after several seconds. "What do you want?"
"Money."
"Money?"
£20,000, you can pay it how you like. I'd prefer King Bartholomew's frowning face on the coins, but I'll take guilders or pesos. Even gold bullion, if that's all you've got."
"Why, you?" he sputtered. "This is robbery," said the pirate to the highwayman. "If you think I'm going to pay..."
"Barker, fire two more missiles," Drake said. Two more streaked out, joining the first. To the pirate captain, he said, "You know I can take you. I'm in position. If you try to come around at this distance, I'll fire off my missiles to keep your shields up, then stand by to knock you apart with a broadside when you close. My own damaged shields will never be a factor." Drake glanced at Commander Tolvern, who stood to one side, chewing her lip. "My commander thinks I could take you with my chase gun alone. I'm tempted to try, if only for the sport."
Vargas cursed him. Jane's voice spoke up again.
1 minute to impact. Expected shield damage, 27%.
"Now, I'm no mathematician," Drake said. "But after the second pair strikes, it seems that your shields will be at 46%, optimistically speaking."
"Stop, disarm the missiles, I'll pay."
Vargas waved his hand to the young woman, who had moved off to a computer at one side.
"Cut power, come to."
Tech Officer Smythe waved his hand, and Drake looked over to see the young man shaking his head and pointing to his console. Drake looked down at his own display to see what Smythe was sending over. It showed Captain Kidd still accelerating. What's more, Vargas was bringing out some sort of weapon system. Cap started to say something, but Tolvern held out a hand to stop the other young woman before she could give the pirates information through the open channel.
"You're lying," Drake started to tell the other captain. Then all systems suffered a hitch, and everything turned black. Everything was offline for 2 long seconds, then the systems began to recover. When the lights came back up, lights and alarms were flashing everywhere. Captain Kidd had disappeared from the screen. Captain Kidd had hit them with what the Navy called a flashbang. It was a huge electromagnetic pulse, often with a neutron burst. Shields caught most of it, but as it washed over the hull, it forced backup systems online while everything resolved itself. Smythe worked furiously to regain control, while Tolvern shouted back and forth with Barker.
"Missile impact in..." Jane began. "Recalculating. Recalculating."
She was recalculating because the second pair of missiles were squirting in random directions, like balloons inflated and then sent shooting off with a hiss of air and corkscrew flights. There wasn't going to be an impact to calculate.
"What about the first salvo?" Drake asked.
"One of the missiles hit, sir," Tolvern said. "Minimal damage. The other is gone. Hard to say what happened. There she is."
She, in this case, was Captain Kidd, now appearing on the screen. Vargas had turned her around, and she was coming up at Ajax's belly, where shields were weakest after Rutherford's attack.
"Roll her over,"
Drake said, sensing what the enemy ship intended.
"Full barrage."
The pirate ship fired missiles at distance and torpedoes as she closed. Barker fired the Gatling guns, taking out the first missiles. Then Tolvern rolled as Drake had ordered. There was something off with the antigrav after the flashbang attack, and he was first lifted in his seat and then slammed down, as if by a lead fist crushing the air from his lungs. He almost blacked out. Cap had fallen from her seat and now crawled shakily back up. The aft shields took the punishment of the torpedoes. Jane's warning voice came on to tell him just how badly they'd been damaged, but he ignored her, ordering another roll, this time to present cannon. Captain Kidd executed its own rolling maneuver, and the two ships squared against each other like a pair of old Earth sailing ships aiming their cannon, preparing to stand and trade blows at a few dozen yards. In this case, a few hundred miles, but the effect was the same. The enemy ship loomed in the viewscreen. A white skull lay atop 2 crossed sabers. It was the bloody Jolly Roger. Vargas. The cocky fool wasn't hiding his piracy. He was reveling in it. Captain Kidd got the first shot, raking Ajax's exposed side. But she only had 3 cannon. Ajax had 8 heavy cannon. Barker took his time before firing. Explosions lit up alongside the Captain Kidd from stern to bow, blooming red and orange. The pirate ship fired again, then made to break free.
Ajax launched another broadside. These projectiles hit the armored underbelly of the enemy ship, but as it spun away, bits of debris spiraled into space, broken out by explosive decompression of failing airlocks. They'd punched through the pirate ship's armor. The pirate ship tried to flee, but Drake brought Ajax in behind to give pursuit. He felt his bloodlust rising, like an ancient Viking warrior locked deep in his DNA, now breaking free, grinning savagely, ready to deliver the killing blow. No, that wasn't his intent. "Hail, Captain Kidd," he said, intending to demand a surrender.
"Enemy communication system offline," Jane's voice said. "We must have knocked it out," Tolvern said.
Drake called down to Barker. "The pirates can't hear us. Fire a warning shot across a bow." Then to Tolvern. "We'll force her to a halt and communicate via signal flares if she can't come back online." After a few seconds, another missile streaked from Ajax's bays. It overtook Captain Kidd and flashed over her bow. The missile then doubled back and raced once more toward the pirate ship. It exploded harmlessly in front of the ship's bow. Drake smiled at Barker's freelancing. The implication was obvious. "We can destroy you at any time." But the enemy didn't seem to get the message.
"They're not slowing," Tolvern said.
"I see that. Jane, give me status of enemy shields."
"Estimating. Starboard shield, 43%. Rear shield, 92%. Deck shield, 98%. Port shield, 100%. Deck shield, 100%. Confidence level of estimate, medium high."
Captain Kidd had weathered the encounter better than expected. The exchange of broadsides had ripped her up pretty good, but Drake was disappointed in the damage caused by that initial missile strike. He needed something kinetic. "Baka," he told the gunner, "give me torpedo bays 1 and 2, now." Two torpedoes left Ajax. They moved sluggishly at first, and only gradually pulled away from the cruiser as they closed the distance to the rear of the enemy ship. On the view screen, they presented a similar profile to the missiles but were heavier, made of depleted uranium, with an explosive first stage. At 50 miles, the noses of the torpedoes broke off, raced ahead, and detonated against the rear shields. While the shields were dealing with this, the main mass of the torpedoes slammed into Captain Kidd, one after the other. There was a double flash. When the view screen came back, the pirate ship was flaring plasma, no longer accelerating. "Jane, enemy rear shields," Drake demanded.
"Estimating."
Jane waited.
"Estimating. Recalculating."
She was having a hard time calculating through the secondary explosions rippling along the back side of the pirate ship. No time to wait.
"Bring her along starboard. Present broadside."
Cap worked the controls, with Tolvern giving orders to the gunners and engineers. They tried to come along the weakened side of the enemy ship, but the pirates rolled expertly away to present their stronger shields. The enemy got off a shot with one of her cannon as she rolled around again, and Ajax shuddered from the fire. Warnings flashed on his console. Jane finally came through.
"Rear enemy shield at 12%.
"Take her back," Drake ordered. "Chase gun at the engines. We'll disable her from behind."
They rained metal on the enemy ship, trying to destroy what remained of the rear shields. Captain Kidd continued doggedly fighting back. They were clearly beaten. Gases were venting like streams of milky liquid into the vacuum. One of those torpedoes had penetrated the airlocks.
"Blast you, Vargas," Drake said. "Why won't you surrender?"
Smythe piped up from his computer.
"Enemy engines are overheating. Seems to be purposeful. I think they're readying a countermeasure."
"Watch it," Cap said. "It's another trick."
Yes, like the flashbang. But Drake wasn't going to sit still to find out what. Next time might be more lethal. He had the rear shields demolished. A couple of missiles up the tailpipe would vaporize the ship. But he still hoped to disable her.
"Torpedo 3 and 4, he called down to Barker.
Two more torpedoes blasted loose. They were so close that the initial detonations shuddered through the hull of Ajax as well. The uranium rods
thrust deeply into Captain Kidd, their progress visible all along the hull as flames jetted into space where they passed. One of them passed all the way through, hurtling out the front like a bullet going through a watermelon. Drake ordered them to pull back, worried the whole ship would blow apart, fissionable materials and all. His own shields were damaged, and he didn't want to be battered with Captain Kidd's debris. But after a few seconds, the fires finished venting along the enemy ship. Her engines blinked and went out, and then she was flying dead through space. No return fire. No signs of life whatsoever. A ragged cheer went up from the others on the bridge. Drake didn't join them, already thinking of how best to salvage the situation. Chapter 14. An hour later, when Ajax had harpooned Captain Kidd and brought both ships to a halt somewhere in the deep, empty space on the edge of the Phantalus system, a signal finally came through from the pirates. Captain Vargas appeared on the screen. He wore a bloody bandage over his forehead that also covered one eye. No sign of his daughter or any other crew. He kept his own view close, no doubt so that Drake couldn't see the state of the bridge. The air was hazy, filled with smoke. Drake leaned back casually in his chair.
"You could have saved us both a lot of trouble."
"Damn you, what do you want?"
"I told you, £20,000.
Vargas clenched his jaw.
"I don't have it."
"I don't believe you. You were coming from Barca, right? It wasn't on a mercy mission. No doubt smuggling or preying on merchants. I'll bet you are loaded with gold and trade goods."
"Any profits I was carrying have now been vaporized. Half my ship is destroyed. Would have burned us all to a crisp if you hadn't also punctured my hull so many places there wasn't enough oxygen for fire."
"We'll see about that. I'm sure you won't mind a boarding party."
"Send them over. We'll give you one hell of a welcome."
"Yes, now that you mention it, I should probably knock a few more holes in you first. There might still be too much oxygen on board. Wouldn't want another fire to break out. That is, if you intend to resist." Vargas's face went pale.
"You have to at least give me terms."
"Terms are, we won't hang you as pirates. How does that sound? I'll put you down on a neutral planet with some pocket change and your sidearms, because I'm not a cruel man." Drake cut the link.
"Is there going to be another boarding party?"
Cap asked. She sounded eager. Tolvern looked concerned. "Attacking a slaver is one thing. Brawling with pirates on their home turf is another thing entirely."
"Half of them were probably killed," Cap said.
"Which would make the survivors all the more desperate."
"We could always pepper her with more shot," Tolvern said. "Vent out some of the air, like you said. Suffocating pirates are docile pirates."
"I'm not so keen on killing men and women in cold blood."
"They'd do the same to us," she said.
"All the more reason to act civilized."
He was still turning this over when Barker came onto the comlink.
"Captain, there's something down here you should look at."
"I'm coming." Drake cut the link and turned back to Cap. "Write up the specifications of that jump point and send them to my computer."
"Write them, sir?"
Cap looked suddenly nervous. "Yes, I want to read your analysis," he said impatiently. "What speed do we need? What's the best approach and all that? We're coming out next to that star and I want some numbers."
"Oh, if it's just numbers, I can tell Tolvern and have her send them." "If you're too lazy for hard thinking," Tolvern said, "maybe you should go down to the kitchen and see if they need a dishwasher." "It's not that,"
Cap began. She cast her eyes about desperately. "I want your analysis in 10 minutes, Drake said. "Can you do that or not?"
I'll do it, sir."
Drake made his way to the engineering bay. The big warehouse-like room could hold equipment for Royal Marines, but had been mostly empty since the mutiny, except for locked weapons bins and mechanical suits for the bosuns, as well as other scattered equipment. Now there were battered metal crates and bits of scorched debris strewn across the floor. Barker and Carvalho were picking through it, with the latter using a computer to catalog what they found.
Barker looked younger, more energetic than he had in years, and he seemed to have lost several pounds around his waist. He still had the walrus mustache, and was now letting his beard grow out to meet it. He wore his new insignia on the shoulder of his orange mechanic suit, which made Drake smile. He'd expected Cap to be invigorated and hopefully more loyal from her promotion, but hadn't expected any such transformation in the gruff old gunner. Barker had been at his current rank and position for years, and Drake had always assumed he was satisfied with it. Apparently not. Barker looked up as Drake approached.
"This is all stuff we found floating around Captain Kidd when we hauled her in. What's left of her cargo and other debris. I thought we might find something valuable."
"Is this the part where you tell me you found Captain Vargas's treasure chest, and there just happens to be 20,000 pounds in gold and silver coin?"
"Afraid not."
Barker pulled his hand out of his pocket and hooked his thumb at Carvalho.
"You think I'd let this pirate down here if I had?"
Carvalho flashed a toothy grin. Drake grunted.
"What I found was this."
Barker opened one of the scorched chests. It was filled with sugar sacks. Some of the sugar was partially burned, even caramelized by the heat.
"Seems to be 90% of what they were carrying," Barker said. "Just sugar. Wouldn't think there'd be enough profit to attract pirates."
Yes, it was quite strange. The York Company had a monopoly on the sugar trade, although that didn't entirely prevent smuggling, of course. He thought about where Vargas had been heading, one of the neutral worlds on the frontier. Under the terms of the treaty with the Empire, Albion was forbidden to export sugar to any of those planets. That meant there was profit for those who could get it through. Still, a big ship like Captain Kidd had a lot of overhead. Surely there wasn't enough profit or risk in sugar to attract the likes of Vargas and his crew.
"I want all this dumped." Drake gave Carvalho a significant look. "Remember what I said, no sugar on board. We need our pilot." "Aye," Barker said. "I would have done it, but thought you might want to have a look first."
"And nothing else turned up?" he asked. "Just sugar."
"That's pretty much it," Barker said. "Well, as far as cargo goes, come check this out."
The two men led him to the rear of the engineering bay. There, Barker kicked apart some random bits of metal to clear a single large, flat piece of the enemy decking blown off during the assault, some 40 feet square, battleship gray, except for what had been painted onto its surface, a skull, sitting above two crossed sabers.
"We took a trophy," Barker said with a grin.
"I'd say that's a good day's work for a Royal Navy cruiser," Drake said. "Except we currently have more in common with the pirates. Maybe we should give it back with our apologies."
"I was thinking we'd keep it for our own use."
Drake sent up an eyebrow.
"Oh?" "Sure enough, I'll cut out the plate above your bridge and weld this in its place. We better start showing the pirate colors if we're going to earn a reputation."
Drake snorted at this. "We do that, we'd better rechristen the ship. HMS Ajax seems inappropriate, don't you think?"
"I hear Captain Kidd is suddenly available."
"Turned out that wasn't such a fearsome name. We need something better. How does Blackbeard sound?" Barker chuckled at this.
"Starship Blackbeard. Rolls nicely off the tongue."
He turned to Carvalho.
"Get suited up and stack the sugar in the main incinerator."
Drake watched the former prisoner make his way to the mechanical suits on the far wall, still suspicious of his intentions. He waited until the man started putting on the suit before turning back to Barker.
"Speaking of Captain Kidd, I want to take her with us to San Pablo." "Why?"
"I need money, but not so badly that I'd sell sugar to get it. Vargas says he has nothing of value left on board. I'm inclined to believe him, so I thought we'd see what we can get selling his ship for scrap."
"She ain't worth much anymore."
"Not what she was a few hours ago, I'll agree. But she's worth something. Let's say the engines can be salvaged. That's 10,000 right there."
"Maybe 8, Barker said.
8, then. We could get another 10 or 15 from the rest of it."
"I don't know. Depends on what she looks like when you get inside."
"Whatever we get would go a long way toward repairs and resupply,"
Drake said. Even 10,000 pounds would make a difference. Problem is, how do I carry her through the jump point? He pulled out his computer. There was Cap's analysis, and now he understood her reticence in writing it. He could barely parse her poor English. The sentences were fragmented, the spelling its own dialect. The lower-class speech patterns, what they called York Cockney, now sounded in his mind's ear like glass scraping on metal when he read them. His first inclination was to be irritated. Maybe if Cap didn't balk when asked to write, she'd sound more clever than a sod digger in the Canadian peat bogs. No doubt that's why the Navy had kept her out of pilot school. But then he thought about how she must have felt writing it, worried he would stare at it and think she was an uneducated dolt. And anyway, the numbers looked good, as did the analysis, once he got past the clumsy prose. Their target in Fantalus was a loose jump point, which meant they could arrive at a lazier angle at a slower speed and still make it out of the system. The jump point on the other side was a bit trickier. They'd need to accelerate while coming in at a precise XYZ angle with minimal deviation. After that jump, Cap's knowledge broke down. The third jump, the one that would take them to San Pablo, might be unstable. She'd need to consult the nav computer when they got through. He shared this information with Barker to get his opinion. The engineer frowned and rubbed at his stubbly chin.
I don't know. I could probably coax .095 from the engines while towing the pirates, but accelerating on the other end, while caught in the star's gravity well? Also, that close in, we'd need to shift power to the cooling systems or we'd bake to a crisp.
So we can't take her with us, Drake said, frustrated.
That would be my assessment, not with the current deficiencies in equipment and piloting.
A high, melodic voice sounded from behind the two men.
What if I promise a piloting upgrade? Could you manage then?
Drake turned on his heel. Nib Pym had stepped through the doors into the engineering bay and was taking long strides toward them. He'd pulled on a shirt, though he was still barefoot. His color was better, and his eyes had lost the milky look. Nevertheless, his unexpected presence was alarming.
"Who let you out?"
Drake demanded. Nib Pym gave the quick wrist turn that was the Hroom equivalent of a shrug.
"The pirates let me out, it would seem. There was a flash and the power went out. The doors opened. I went into the hallway and there was no guard."
Oh yes, the flashbang. Must have caused the doors to open. And since the ship was designed to bring critical systems online first, the Hroom might have had several seconds in which to make his escape.
"That was 2 hours ago. Nobody noticed you were missing,"